Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing okay, Justin. How are you?
I am great. Let me tell you about my day real quick. I was up at 8 a.m. finishing up my notes for this case. By noon, I was speaking with a male rape survivor. By the afternoon, I was working on my peripheral. The time I was driving out here, I was behind a car with a vanity plate that said, "Love your skin." And I wasn't sure if it was a dermatologist or a serial killer.
Buffalo Bill. And what was Buffalo Bill driving, by the way?
It was a nice car, so I'm going to side with dermatologist. But that's just a Thursday in my life. When I was in Toronto, somebody asked me, how do you separate yourself from the darkness? And I think I said, I just learned to live there.
Yeah, it'll get pretty dark on this episode, I think.
I'm trying to make a few jokes to lighten the mood because this episode is probably one of the most disturbing ones that I've researched myself.
Before we get started, for everyone that knows or doesn't know, Justin has the peripheral. Justin, you want to give a brief description just in case people don't understand what the peripheral is?
It's I talk to listeners. They tell personal stories of survival of whether it be sexual assault, mental illness, drug addiction, or just some kind of random stories. I feel that when we talk about true crime, we always have to gloss over these topics and never give them their time that they deserve. So I focus on one topic per episode with somebody's story. And it's very mental health based, but it's not clinical. You're hearing a raw story from somebody, and that's about it. You are now starting a podcast, so we're going to have zero time in our lives. What's your podcast, Aaron?
Well, I already had zero time. The new podcast is Framed, an Investigative Story, and it launches on August 21st. I think if you poke around on iTunes, you might actually see that it's on there. So go ahead and subscribe. It involves myself as a host, but while I might be narrating, there are also voices that you'll hear, you know, from testimony, from police reports, from the people that were involved in the case. Not necessarily the actual people in every case, but it's sort of like a mix between a podcast and an audiobook. You should definitely tune in and check it out. I think it's going to be pretty great, but Tune in and let me know what you think. If you need updates, framedpod.com or framedpod on Twitter.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Tonight's case takes place in 2002 in Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, home of the Indians. I think back in 2002... Nickelback had the number one hit on the radio. I actually knew the girl that was in the video, How You Remind Me. I think they get a pretty bad rap for being the Jar Jar of the alternative rock world now. Speaking of Jar Jar, Attack of the Clones, Star Wars, was another movie, big hit during 2002. I personally never listened to Nickelback. I listened to A Whisper in the Noise, Through the Ides of March myself. So that's the time frame and the location. What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about the three women who were kidnapped and held captive in a home in Cleveland by a man that they sort of knew.
For about 10 years.
Yeah, let's give the women's names. They are Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Gina DeJesus. Michelle Knight was the first person to disappear. She grew up poor. Early on in life, she lived in a station wagon with her twin brothers and a cousin and her parents. They frequently moved, living in the worst parts of town. Because her parents were having to scrape by, she was the one that was actually acting as the mother for these little ones. So she was getting them ready. She said that they didn't really have the means to take showers every day or to brush their teeth every day. So when they could, it was a big deal. And she really wanted to make sure that each time that she got to brush the teeth of these kids, that she did the best that she could. And this is just the reality of people who are living at the poverty level. Over time, relatives were staying with them, and one male relative of hers started to abuse her from a young age on. She was teased in school a lot, mostly because of the way she smelled, because she just couldn't shower, as I said.
She couldn't wash her clothes or anything, yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of her clothing, her parents got it from like the Goodwill store and places like that, so she was wearing clothing that was really outdated. Decades outdated. And so people would tease her about that.
It's also said she was assaulted in school.
But even though she seemed to have it kind of rough, she took pleasure in some things, like she enjoyed drawing. Mostly she drew families enjoying time together and wolves. She had a thing for wolves. She was also really into the horror genre, which we can identify with. She really liked Stephen King books and scary films.
Yeah.
When she was 15 years old, she wanted to stop the abuse that was happening to her. You know, the living arrangement was odd because she would just sleep wherever she could, but this guy would find her in the night.
She tried hiding in the closet. That usually didn't work. And one night she put two sleeping pills in his drink. It knocked him out. So she grabbed some of her things in a backpack and she went out the bathroom window. Now, that was her plan. And we've talked about this on the Andrew Gosden episode where sometimes your plan is very simple. You can get from point A to point A, point one, yeah. But beyond that, you don't really have a plan. You just want to make it out a window, essentially, and that's what she did. Now, she was homeless, so she started living under an overpass, and she stole a garbage can so she'd have something to sleep in. She would actually use the lid. Now, the reason why she could do this is because she was only, and this is as tall as she ever got, was 4'7". So she's pretty tiny.
Her nickname was Shorty.
Yeah. Yeah. Very short. She even took a baseball bat out of a yard so she would have some protection. She was out wandering around. You know, she usually went into town. You know, sometimes she had to steal food or, you know, maybe she could get a handout or something. A tall black man approached her from a church. I think it was a Baptist church. He expressed concern for her and she nicknamed him Arsenio because his haircut reminded her of Arsenio Hall. So I think it was like a triangle haircut, maybe.
Yeah, but he wasn't around by 2002.
Well, he was, but he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't as famous. But yeah. He told her about the church and how they gave out meals once every weekday for dinner, I think it was. And so she started going there and she met some of the people at the church and everybody there was really nice. So she would make it a habit to go over there. It gave her a little bit of brightness in her miserable life. Well, then one day she's approached by a man when she's under the overpass and his name is Sniper. Now he introduces himself to her and she's nervous and she's gripping her bat because she doesn't know what his intentions are. But he says that he wants to help her out. He knows that she doesn't have any food. She has no money. And so he offers her some help. But what he needs from her is that she needs to be a drug runner. Now, I know right off the bat, this sounds pretty bad because he's recruiting her to do something illegal. But on the other hand, this guy who appears to be 18 or 19 years old, he's very kind to her. And when he takes her back to his house, he introduces her to another drug runner there who's from Saudi Arabia. His name is Roderick. And she hits it off right away with him, almost like brother and sister.
So they're giving her kind of a place to live, a place to clean up, but they need her help.
Yeah, yeah. She has access to a shower. And Sniper actually says, this over here is my room. You can stay in it. I will sleep on the couch downstairs. He's giving her everything she needs. And he's going to give her money every week. So she has a roof. She has shower. She has deodorant. And she has, you know, I mean, this is what she didn't have before. He's giving her everything she needs.
So she has a church. And she has a drug-dealing, drug-running friend who are helping her out.
Yeah, so it's some people will judge this and say it's not a very good arrangement, but for her, this is the best she's had it ever.
It's got her off the street.
Yeah, she's terrible at running drugs.
Well, she's had no practice, right?
Right. He's trying to help her out with that, tell her how to gauge, how to talk with people, know when to leave a situation, when to kind of step it up. And he also teaches her how to shoot a gun. And he gives her a Glock 22 and he says, when you get into a bad situation, always run. But if you can't run and if you fear for your life, that's when you need this gun.
He took a conceal and carry course.
Well, it almost sounds like it. But again, he's giving her, you know, what he thinks she needs. Yeah, again, he's a criminal, but he's being kind to her.
Sadly, he's giving her purpose.
Roderick and Michelle are talking and she says that she says that she's part Arabic and he gives her a hijab. Yeah, it's like a headscarf.
Yeah.
And his mother had made it and he gives it to her and he says, you're my sister. It meant a lot to her. She has someone that cares about her and that she can talk to. She has no romantic interest in these guys, but...
And they're not taking advantage of her in any sexual way or anything.
No, it's everything is on the level there.
I have to respect this unconventional situation.
Well, again, she came from such a bad background. I mean, her family wasn't really there for her. You know, her brothers were too young to really help her out or anything. So this is her striking out on her own, and she was tired of the abuse. She was tired of not having an actual family life. That's all she ever wanted. But one day, the cops raid Sniper's place.
Of course they do.
Roderick makes it out. And when she runs across him, she's, you know, he tells her, like, oh, the place has been raided. We've got to get out of here. So she takes him to the one place she knows about, which is the overpass. She's like, you got to get a garbage can to move into.
Yeah.
He does his best, but he finds one that has no lid. And I think, frankly, he might have been a little too big to have a lid anyway. One day, and this is just within a matter of days, I think within 5 days or so, a woman spots her down under the overpass. It's a neighbor on the street where her family lives. And she thinks, great, I've been found out. And sure enough, that woman calls her dad immediately and says, I know where your daughter is. And he shows up within like 20 minutes.
Because she's living under an overpass and he's going to discipline her for running away.
Yeah. Why the hell did you run away? You're coming back with me. She didn't want to go, but you know, he wasn't hearing that. She heads back with him to the house. And that evening, her male relative shows back up and whispers in her ear, you really thought you could get away from me.
This is a lot of foreshadowing to things that happen later, but it's necessary to understand what kind of life she had to understand her actions later.
Now, this next part is, there's some disagreement here on exactly how Michelle becomes pregnant, but I'll just give her version because I felt like if this is the way she wanted to express it in her book, then that's the way she wants us to think of it.
Yeah.
She started dating a boy who she says was tall and he was nice to her. She ends up pregnant. But it's not long after that that she finds out that he has already been dating someone else. And when he has to choose between these two women, he drops Michelle.
So she's how old and pregnant now?
17.
Yeah. And I'm sure her family's not going to be happy about this.
No. Her abuser is continuing to abuse her. It's about this time where she's just really angry. And I think, you know, she's had enough of this life. She already tried to get away from it before and couldn't. And she's back in it. And now she's starting to strike and kick at this guy whenever he starts trying to grope her.
Fight back.
She's fighting back. And he's starting to back off. And frankly, during that part of the book, I felt good because it sucks reading about someone who's suffering abuse and just isn't able to stop it. Her son, Joseph, who she calls Joey, was born on October 24th, 1999. By this point, her mom had gotten rid of her, you know, Michelle's dad. She got a new guy. His name was Carlos. Carlos was around a lot, but he also tended to drink a lot. When Joey was just a little kid, Carlos was drunk and at the house with Joey, but Michelle had been gone. She was trying to find a job. She was putting in applications places and came home. She had thought her mother was there watching the kid, but her mother had left. Her son burst into tears when she came in the door. Carlos was very upset by this. I guess, you know, he had been angry that day. He was ticked off at having to watch this kid. And he reached out and grabbed Joey by the leg and ended up fracturing his leg. So Michelle took him to the hospital. Of course, everyone there wants to know what happened to your little one. And she said, oh, he had an accident at the park.
But they're seeing the injuries and knowing that it's abuse.
Well, they suspect that it's abuse. So Carlos called the hospital and said, I'm the one who hurt the little boy. It was me. I was drunk. I grabbed him and I didn't mean to do it, but I hurt him.
But now they know the child is in a dangerous home or situation and he's not going back to that dangerous situation.
Not only that, but the mother lied. Now, Michelle knows that her child could be taken from her. This child is her world. You know, we talked about having purpose. When she became a mother, that was her purpose. She even strove to get a job even more so after she became a mother because she wanted to provide for her kid. But things are looking bad now because social services are getting involved.
It's social services and CPS.
Her son was taken from her and placed in foster care. For those that don't know, when your child's placed in foster care, it's not like a family is awarded the child for a while and then the child stays there until something gets figured out. The child can often be moved many times in just a matter of months.
It can be very traumatic for the kid. It's not a simple process.
For one, they're being taken from their mother, who they know. They're being moved around to different families, and all of those situations are different.
Typically, they try to find a family member to place the kid, but if there isn't one, and we kind of see the reputation of her family, yeah, they're just going to go to a stranger's house.
In 2002, she's doing what she can. She's told that she has to make these appointments, and by make, I mean she has to show up to these appointments, and they're in the towns of wherever Joey's at.
She has to travel. She has to find transportation on their schedule, not hers.
And she has no car, and she doesn't really know her way around either, but these are visitations that will be monitored. Someone will be there with her while she's with her kid, watching everything. She can make some of these appointments, but some she can't. This is very hard on her because she knows that every time she fails to make an appointment, it's another knock against her. She's really going to have to work to try and make this happen, and it's not easy. At this point, she had moved out of the house and moved in with her cousin Lisa, who was about 10 years older than her. Lisa was like, you know, we'll get you fixed up. You'll be fine. This is a good house. We'll get your kid back. I'm going to introduce you to people so you won't be alone. Deanna, who's a cousin. And then she also is introduced to Emily Castro, whose father was a bus driver named Ariel.
Dun, dun, dun.
One day she's out with her cousin and she's trying to find where this appointment is at. It's at some office. She thinks it's downtown, but she can't find anybody who knows where this office is at. And she's showing them the address. She's even calling. And the people at the office are basically like, you know, you need to just get here.
Yeah, well, if you've ever called a government building, it's always so fun.
At some point, she tells her cousin, you know, hey, you just walk back towards home. I'm going to call the office one more time and see if I can figure out where this is at. And meanwhile, she's running out of time. And if she doesn't make it, she really feels like this is going to be bad. She gets the runaround again. She goes into a Family Dollar store. Now, she had been told that the location might be really close by that Family Dollar store. So she was hopeful.
Just within walking distance or something?
Yeah, just down the street.
They're at West 106th and Lorraine.
But in line behind her at the Family Dollar store is Ariel Castro, who she doesn't really know him. He says, hey, can you help me? I'm trying to find my bank. And she says, you know, what's your bank? He tells her, and then she says, oh, I know where that's at. And then he says, well, you were just asking about how to find a place. You help me, I'll help you.
Sounds like great opportunity. And she needs to get there.
And she kind of knows his daughter. So she says, okay.
She's going to get in his car. And then she disappears. She's 21 at the time now.
Amanda Berry wanted to design clothes. She was well known for keeping her clothes organized by color and her shoes organized by heel height. She loved clothing. She loved to color coordinate. She had ideas about style and design. So she really wanted to get into that. Not just that, but she noticed how her mother struggled. I would say that her mother struggled with the bills after Amanda's dad left, but he wasn't known to contribute much anyway. That really, I don't think, had a big bearing on their financial situation. Her mother was always working really low-end jobs, trying to keep them afloat. Amanda didn't resent her mother for that. She just used it as inspiration to say, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to do better. I will earn more money and then down the road I can help my mom out too.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business.
If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Now, Amanda works at a Burger King. Her sister is married to a guy who's the manager of the place.
This Burger King is on 110th Street and Lorraine Avenue, just 4 blocks away from where Michelle disappeared.
This is the day of her birthday, I think.
This is April 21st, 2003. I heard day before her 17th, but...
Yeah, it's either the day before or the day of her birthday. She's not in a good mood because she hadn't been getting along with her mom. Her sister had told her over the phone how she and her husband got in a big fight and her husband had said some mean stuff to her or whatever. And so she had to go to work. Another guy that worked there said, "Hey, do you want to get out of work early today?" And she was all for it. But if she gets out of work early, then she's going to have to figure out
a ride.
Yeah, she's going to have to figure out how to get home. She was supposed to have her boyfriend pick her up, but for whatever reason, she can't get a hold of him. His name is DJ, and she's calling, texting, whatever. She has a phone, and not everyone in this area has a phone.
No. I mean, this, again, 2003 now. Cell phones are starting to pick up. Back in the flip phone days, not everyone has it. They're expensive.
Now, when she's heading out, she sees a man in a maroon van and what appears to be his daughter next to him. You know how it is. If you just see a couple of people, you look and you think, oh, well, that's the dad and that's the daughter.
You judge off age and whatnot.
Well, she's messing with her phone and she's walking along. And then all of a sudden, this van pulls up next to her and the guy says, "Hey, do you need a ride?" She's like, "Yeah, I should take the ride." Well, even though I'm not that far now from where I need to go. But she thought, oh, that's really nice of him. And she had seen a young lady in the vehicle with him. So she thought, hey, this seems cool, right? She gets in the van and she notices that this young woman that was in the vehicle is no longer there.
So now she's feeling a little anxious about what she's just done.
Yeah, it feels a little weird. Like, maybe I wouldn't have done that if I had known this girl had gotten out of the van. But he compliments her on her phone. He says, "Hey, that's a nice phone you have there." He says, "I'll take you home." She had thought she recognized the girl in the van as someone she knew, a woman named Angela Castro.
Probably was the person in the van just moments before.
But had gotten out. And so he says, "Hey, do you want to see my daughter? She's at home." And she says, "Sure, I guess I could visit," because she wasn't getting along with her mom. And she was like, "Heck, I'll go socialize. That'll be fine." So she heads back with him as he's pulling up onto his property. He says, "Can I see your phone a minute?" So she hands him her phone. And then he says, "Hold on, I got to move the dog." He has a chow that's chained up in the yard.
So now he has her phone, and he kind of has control of the situation.
And Amanda Berry disappears.
It's about a year later. We are at April 2nd, 2004. We have 14-year-old Gina DeJesus.
Gina lived with her parents, her brother, sister, and then her sister's two kids. Life was pretty good. Her family got along really well. It was a happy household, I would say. Gina's only real issue, as you know, her parents might point out, would be that she was very shy around strangers. She would not look people in the eye, which I don't think is a big deal. But, you know, her mom wanted her to socialize more and be more confident. You know how parents are. She would always head out in the morning with her dad. Her dad would head off to take her to school and drop her off early. So she'd have to wait outside for a while with a few other kids. And then he would go on to work. Now, the car they were driving was a white Nissan he had bought from a girl that she was friends with named Arlene Castro.
If you're not seeing a pattern here yet, I think it's clear now.
Gina was placed in education classes for slow learners and was teased for riding the short bus. That's why her dad wanted to make sure he could drive her to school, because he cared about how she was feeling.
Why are kids so mean? You know, you don't wear nice clothes, you get teased. If you are short, you get teased. If you ride a certain bus, come on, man.
The good news for Gina, though, was at this time, her grades were picking up, and her teacher was even telling her, hey, you're on track to be able to move into regular classes. Gina, you know, just like Amanda, was not content to just go through the motions here. She was striving for more. She was picking up her grades. She was even told, hey, if you keep this up, someday you could go to college. Gina was inspired by that. Gina was inspired by that. And so she was intending to just keep pushing forward. She wanted to become the first person in her family to graduate college. This is at 14. So she's already thinking about her future, which is pretty admirable, because at 14, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And Gina was already looking at college. I mean, she had her eyes set on the prize, as it were. She leaves at the end of school with her friend Arlene. And she suddenly thinks, hey, we should go roller skating, because both of them like to ice skate and roller skate. But she really wanted to go roller skating. That was her favorite activity. Then she remembered, though, that she was grounded. And she was grounded because her parents had caught her smoking a cigarette in her room.
Why is she smoking at such a young age?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But Arlene says, hey, maybe they'll let you come over to my house and you can hang out with me at my house. Well, Arlene calls. Gina can tell that it's not going to work out. And sure enough, Arlene says, yeah, I just have to go home. So Gina said it was a 40-minute walk to get back home for her. A block away from, at that point, a Jeep Grand Cherokee pulled up. And it was Arlene's dad. And he said, hey, have you seen Arlene? I'm looking for her. And she's like, yeah, I was just with her. She went that way. And he said, great, can you get in and help me find her?
She says, sure. I mean, it's her friend's dad. Makes sense. I know there was a phone booth right there that is what people consider the last place she was seen. This is at 105th and Lorraine Avenue. So we have 106th, 110th, and 105th on the same street.
And each of these girls had some connection to one of his kids.
Absolutely. A level of trust there.
It's an automatic trust, because you say, well, I know this person and I like them, and then this is their dad. No one knew where these women had gone to. And furthermore, Michelle wasn't really missed.
After 15 months-ish, law enforcement tried to call her family, contact anyone to find out if she had returned home or if she was still missing. Well, you know how her family is. They couldn't get through to anybody. So they took her off the missing persons list, which, wow. I would just assume that you would leave the person on until you had confirmation that they were no longer missing, not remove them from the list if you can't get confirmation. I realize it's a long list, but she's no longer an active investigation.
The other two girls, their families missed them and were contacting law enforcement pretty quickly, within hours of when they were expected to be home. They were out there trying to get the media's attention, spread the word about my daughter, my sister, they're missing.
So Gina goes missing on April 2nd, 2004. This is all over the course of 2 years. We have three women, three teens go missing, all within five blocks of each other.
While Gina and Amanda, they're on a list stating they both went missing.
And they're tying them together as this is probably foul play and...
connected.
Yeah, connected.
But Michelle's not on there.
Yeah. It's very unfortunate. So now we have to talk about where these women have gone, where these children have gone. And they're at a house on 2207 Seymour Avenue. It's a two-story house with a basement, four bedrooms, one bathroom. The windows are either boarded up, have cardboard or carpet covering all of them. The front door is pretty much bolted shut and not used. The house is kind of dirty, trashed, and the occupant, Ariel Castro, is the owner.
Yeah, to say that the place is kind of dirty is an understatement. Literally, floors are littered with food wrappers and old food. It's like a hoarder house,
yeah,
is the best way to describe it. Ariel Castro is someone who doesn't shower very often.
No, he's a disgusting person.
He doesn't take care of himself. He drinks a lot and he smokes marijuana. But he plays music. He's a bass player. And he plays with a...
salsa band.
Yeah, a salsa band. He plays a lot of Spanish music.
He's also a school bus driver. He has been for 22 years. That's not creepy at all. When he brings these young ladies back to his house, their initiation is to be led down to the basement and chained to a support pole or to the wall. They are not fed and they're beaten. I think this is anyone's worst nightmare. I don't think that we need to go into too much detail, but this is what we all think about. The worst case scenario when we're abducted.
Yeah, being under the control of a psycho is the best way to put it. They would be chained to the pole. They would have this chain wrapped around their neck and their stomachs and their legs. And they would have their hands bound behind them. And then he would slam a motorcycle helmet down over their heads.
He wanted to muffle their screams. So it was either duct tape or the helmet.
Yeah, he would also take, like, you know, an old sock or a rag and then ball it up and tape it in their mouth.
This is what happens in their initial arrival at the house. This is what would be considered the breaking in period, where he's trying to break them down mentally, destroy their ego, destroy their mental state so they comply. And Michelle Knight, who we assume is his first victim, is left down there for weeks.
When she is given food, it's usually something very undesirable. It could often be a sandwich from McDonald's that is a little old. It's not fresh.
Not that if it was fresh, it would be any better, but that's just me.
No, because, you know, her first thought is she doesn't want anything from him. She doesn't want anything to do with him. She doesn't like the way she's being treated. He's abusing her. So she doesn't want to take the food, but she also knows that if she gives in, then he wins. There's that battle inside of her that, you know, it's survival or do I quit? And she's not going to quit. She wants to survive. So she's going to eat to try and survive.
Yeah.
But Michelle has an allergy to mustard.
This is just worst case scenario of being held captive and having a dietary need.
Right. So this is something where she just can't have it because she'll swell up and she'll have trouble breathing. It's pretty devastating to her system, actually.
he doesn't really unchain them to use the bathroom that often.
They're given usually like a bucket, and then he'll throw a little piece of cardboard over the top of it.
If he even bothers with that.
And it really doesn't matter because he doesn't empty out the bucket, but maybe once every week to 2 weeks. And sometimes he waits too long. Meanwhile, she's not getting new clothes. In other words, he's not giving her a change of clothes. Between the abuse and her having trouble with the bathroom situation, she's getting dingier and dingier.
It's just disgusting. He's dehumanizing them.
She's living in filth. And he already lives in filth, so he doesn't seem to care.
He also has a washer downstairs that he keeps cash in. And I guess he uses the cash to buy things with because he's actually on unemployment. I'm assuming that if they knew how much money he had, they might cut off his aid. So he has this weird store of cash.
Yeah, it's weird that he keeps it in the washer.
I guess he just assumes nobody's going to come downstairs and look in the washing machine to find this money.
Let's make this clear for everyone. If you went into his home, you would find that many of the doors in his home were padlocked. And that's one of the excuses he gave was, I've got a lot of money downstairs, or it's a mess downstairs, and that's why I keep it padlocked, because I don't want anyone going down there getting hurt or going down there and taking my money.
No, I have to just bring this up because how do you have somebody at your house captive and have guests over, not be found out? And it's said that he either had the radio playing, a TV going full blast. He didn't like having guests over, so he would tell them the house is a mess, I have some dogs, or I don't have anything to eat. He would always make excuses. If you did visit his house, he only came in and out through the back door. And he would meet you on the front porch and then escort you around back into the kitchen. And you were not allowed to leave the kitchen. You probably only spent about 10 to 20 minutes there. That was it. He would walk you out the door.
Yeah, the rooms that were open were the kitchen, his bedroom, which was pretty tiny, and a bathroom. Everything else was locked. And he claimed that he needed the fence and he needed all these locks because it was a really bad neighborhood.
It wasn't the best neighborhood, but wow.
Yeah, the neighborhood had a bad reputation and continues to have a bad reputation from what I understand. But again, a lot of people were poor in the area. But telling Michelle's part of this is a good way to understand what's happening with the different women that were taken, because each of them were brought into the home and put through this rough period. Well, they went through a rough period the entire time they're there, but immediately he let them know that they were under his control. He would lie to them and say, I just need you for 2 months. You'll be out by Christmas. You'll be out by the summer. When I get another girl in here, I'll let you go. He told stories.
So Michelle hears him bring home another girl. She's kind of happy that there's somebody else that's around, but it's disgusting and sad that she knows there's somebody else that's going to go through the same hell and torture that she's going through.
Well, and she has information because her captor has given her a TV, and she can see on the news that Amanda Berry has gone missing.
So she knows who this person is.
And she also knows that her captor had told her how he has a thing for blondes, and Amanda Berry is a blonde. So she can put this together, and she feels terrible because she knows what she's been through. She's been beaten. She's been raped. She's been starved. And the other thing about Ariel is that he acts like he wants to hang out with you sometimes and talk to you about normal things. And then other times he's there just to hurt you and to totally destroy any kind of humanity you have left.
Now, they're searching for at least Gina and Amanda. They have one lead, so just days after Amanda's abduction. They have a phone call from her phone. There's a hang up, and then there's a man on the line that says, I'll bring her back in a few days. She's with me. Now the FBI is
going to try to do something with this because, hey, we have cell phone towers. We got pings. We know it's from her cell phone. So they get in their FBI vans, their undercover vans, right? And they go to the area.
Yeah, the phone call, the pings were both on either side of the interstate. And so when they were looking at that area, it's about a 40-block area. What they decided to do was to drive this undercover van, which I guess looked like a piece of crap. I don't know. They park it in the Family Dollar parking lot, which is the place where Michelle was last at. They kind of set up shop there. And what they're doing is they have all this equipment and they're monitoring just to see if they can get another call come in. If they do, then they can pounce.
Yeah. But no more phone calls are made from her cell phone.
They feared that would happen because Amanda didn't bring a charger with her. I mean, why would she? Right? Yeah. So they figured the phone would eventually die or, you know, and if she was taken, which seemed to be the case, maybe that person wouldn't risk using the phone again. Now, the sad thing is 8 days go by and then the FBI says, well, we're going to have to give up here. And they pull out. They didn't know it, but they were 1,000 feet or so from where these three girls were being held captive.
Gina's father was actually friends with Castro's neighbor, and he would go over there, talk with him, drink a beer, talk about his missing daughter. He was 40 feet away from where his daughter was chained up. I couldn't even imagine. Here's the real sick thing. Well, it's all pretty sick, actually, but during this time, they're having searches, organizing vigils, and there's a guy who shows up, helps with the searches, donates money, and even leads the prayer. And that's Castro. I think it's obvious that he's actually trying to see if they have any leads, if they know anything. And people think he's a nice guy in the neighborhood, so it makes sense that he would come out to these searches and organizations and help out.
Another way to look at it, though, is he might have been enjoying it. Because he knew what was going on and no one else did.
Absolutely.
There were suspects along the way. People that were being looked at because they were suspected of having something to do with one or more of the disappearances. And one of the first ones was DJ, who was Amanda's boyfriend. She hadn't been dating him very long, but she said she really liked him. When he was asked, hey, what do you know about her? He said, I don't care what happened to Amanda.
Wow.
And the only way they know this is because a friend of his wore a wire and asked him some questions. And he straight up told him, I don't care where she's at. I don't care what's happened to her.
Yeah. So if your girlfriend or spouse goes missing, I think you're going to make yourself look pretty suspicious if you're so dismissive of something so terrible.
They search his car and they find evidence of blood in the trunk.
And again, if we didn't know how this story ends, I'd be saying, what's this guy got to hide? Why is he being so dismissive?
They test the blood and it turns out that it was most likely chicken blood, probably from chicken bought at the grocery store. Doesn't tie back to Amanda. There's also a man that had been frequenting where she worked who seemed to have an interest in her, and they check into him. But none of this stuff ever goes anywhere.
Especially a year later when Gina goes missing. How are either of these people connected to Gina? Well, they're not.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
These young women are being held captive in this home on Seymour, and their captor, when he rapes them, there is no protection.
Said that Michelle is impregnated 5 times, and every time she becomes pregnant, he will beat her, punch her in the stomach, hit her with a dumbbell, push her down the stairs, and cause a miscarriage.
Yeah, each time it was, I think, slightly different, but it all involved some horrible beating and usually to her stomach. If you read her book, Finding Me, Michelle's accounts will make you cry.
But it's Amanda who ends up getting pregnant, and he wants to keep the baby.
Yeah, he's treating Amanda a little differently. And I won't say he's being nice to her, because you can't kidnap and rape someone repeatedly and be nice to them. That's not what happens. But in his sick mind, he believes that he's found his wife, and he tells her as much. And so he thinks that he can take this baby around and show it to relatives and say, yeah, this is my girlfriend's baby. It's hard for Amanda, because she gives birth to this girl in this little pool.
What is it, like a kiddie pool or something?
Yeah, it's one of those rigid plastic pools. He brings Michelle in to help with the childbirth. When the baby's born and the baby's name is Jocelyn, she is not able to breathe. And this is something that's common. And so Michelle will actually, it's kind of almost, I would say it's kind of like CPR. And then the baby can breathe.
Yeah, she does mouth to mouth. But the reason why Michelle is down here in this dirty basement delivering a baby is because he told her, if the baby dies, you die. He threatens her. And it's all in this dank, terrible environment. I just in disbelief that this went as well as it did.
But with this new little one in the house, and as she's getting older, their captor is being more careful, because the child, especially when she can walk around and talk a little bit, she notices that these women are being chained up. So he has to unchain Amanda, because that's the mother. She needs to care for the child. And of course, he's threatening them all along the way. Like, if you try anything, I will shoot you.
Yeah. And he's played little games with them where he'll leave one of their doors unlocked and then act like he's left. And then if they come out, he's standing there waiting, and he'll beat them and punish them. He also will punish them by not feeding them. Not that the fast food diet he has them on is that great, but if one of them screws up in his mind, then they're not getting fed. The girls will come together, and if one of them's being punished, the other two will save some food for her and end up sharing. But with this little girl running around now, he's having to unlock the doors more often. He's having to free the house up a little bit, but have his control. One of the neighbors will actually see the little girl walking around in the backyard one day and ask him about it. He'll show a photo of Jocelyn to one of his daughters. Say, hey, this is my girlfriend's kid. Isn't she cute? And his daughter will say, that looks like my kid. Or, you know, she's like, that looks related to our family. That's not your girlfriend's kid. But no one's connecting the dots on where this child has come from. He tells his neighbor, oh, that's my granddaughter. Really, it's his daughter.
He's keeping the women in these different rooms, and he doesn't want Michelle out, really. She barely gets to come out. If it's Jocelyn's birthday or Amanda's birthday, whatever, sometimes he'll let her come down towards the end of the party, but she doesn't get to be down there the whole time like Gina and Amanda. Throughout this whole process, he keeps telling Michelle that she's ugly and that no one would ever want her and that her family never cared to look for her.
Because she's no longer talked about on the news the way Amanda and Gina are.
And in the early days after Amanda was taken, he would let her hear some of her voice messages. She said it's almost like he had listened to them and then would play them up until the point when her mother was about to speak And then he would not play that message because she knew her mother had called and left message too. She had to have. But she would hear from, you know, say a cousin or a friend asking, where are you? It was just another way to torture. And then he also would let them have a radio or let them have a TV. Most of the time they were separated. And he would tell them, I don't want you watching, and I'll put it this way, any shows that have black people in them or listen to music played by black musicians.
What a guy.
He would come in, and if Michelle had listened to anything like that, he would come in and beat her. So a bit of a racist. And that's one of the things when these women started to interact a little bit, when they got to know each other a little bit, because he didn't really want them interacting a lot. They would take little moments to talk to one another and tell each other things. And Michelle wanted to get across to Gina, who she spent more time with, you know, watch out for this. Don't do this. This will make him mad. She just was concerned about Gina. And, you know, Gina was only 14 when she was taken. One of the things that each of these women experienced was, why me? Why did I get taken? Or why am I here? You know, why hasn't God stopped this? Why hasn't the police broken down the door by now? There are all these questions. How am I going to make it another month? Because, I mean, you know, Michelle went without food for a couple of weeks at a time sometimes, especially when she was pregnant. And he was trying to make sure that she wouldn't have a child. But one thing that was found out was he was following at least Amanda and Gina around.
So a little bit of stalking beforehand.
Yes. And he told Gina as much. And they know about Amanda because she fit his profile of what he was looking for. And of course, she's the one that he told her, you know, he told the girls, you know, she's my wife. Gina was pretty surprised because she thought, why would he take me? I'm his daughter's friend. You know, what's going on here? And it's that idea that this is a person that you kind of know. Why would he do that to you? I mean, how many people, even people you know, don't show their true face when they're around everyone else? I was watching comedians in cars getting coffee.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen this.
It's a great show.
Jerry Seinfeld. He had Dave Chappelle on. Dave Chappelle had an interesting comment because he said, when I'm up on stage, that's the real me. I get to be me up there. There's no mask. I get to say and do whatever I want. Unfortunately for these women, Ariel Castro's true self was what he showed them behind these locked doors.
You get a pretty watered down version of Aaron and I on our podcast. And any of you that have met us in person know that we're a little bit more lively and make more jokes and have other things to talk about. But yeah, this guy is a monster, and he's dehumanized them to the point where I know every single one of them considered taking their own lives in the first 6 months. They couldn't imagine surviving in this environment any longer, but they do survive and they do work together to endure this. I think this is less of a story about a monster and more of a story about survival and the persistence of the human will to live.
Yeah, there are so many heartbreaking stories, and they're related through the books that they wrote, because they kept diaries, essentially. For a while, Ariel would bring in journals so they could write in them. You can write whatever you want, but don't write any names. And, you know, he even told Amanda at one point, you can write home and tell them you're okay.
What a lie.
But, of course, she broke a rule because she tried to get out of the room she was in. So he handed her back the letter she had written to her family and said, it's not going anywhere now. Yet being able to write and to draw really helped these women. And at some point when they ran out of pages, because they didn't have anything to do most of the day, they started saving napkins from these fast food restaurants, and they just had to write very carefully so they didn't tear the napkin. I know for a while, Amanda would actually keep a record using a number and an X to signify how many times she was attacked each day by Ariel Castro, because she said, I'm going to survive this, and I want him punished for every act he does. And we know that's when they give you so many counts, when you're charged, that's what this has to do with. How many times did you do something that they can mention? And she was doing that for a while. And then she said at some point, looking back over her, having recorded all these entries, she said it just hurt. And so she just couldn't do that anymore. But she was bound and determined, as the other two were, to survive this, see him pay for his crimes. That goes back to what you were just saying. This isn't so much about him, because he's not the only monster that's ever existed. But when you read about what these women have gone through, and then the fact that they are going to survive that, you know, as we get to the end of the story here, it's amazing. All you can do is think, this is the incredible power of the human spirit to endure and to survive. It's really Jocelyn. Jocelyn is the key here.
Yeah.
Because she reinvigorated them. She gave them a sense of hope, because here's this little girl, very innocent, running around and just happy to see everybody, and was very forthcoming with information. She had the run of the house because he wasn't going to chain her up.
And she would ask him, "You need to start unlocking these doors. I can't get where I need to go." She's sort of the key that is his downfall, and thank God.
What happens, Justin? How does this turn the corner?
Well, Jocelyn's asking for the doors to be unlocked. Whether the monster decided he would do this for the child, or he just assumed, I have total control over them. I've left the doors unlocked in the past, and they won't escape. They won't run away. He decides that he can leave a door unlocked, and he's getting sloppy, I guess. But he tells Jocelyn that he's going to Mom's house. He leaves Amanda's door unlocked, and she figures this out pretty quick. And she asks Jocelyn, where is he? She says, he went to Mom's house. Now, with this information, she knows that he's not hiding downstairs or around the corner waiting for her so he can punish her for escaping her room. She also knows that he's probably going to be gone for a little bit, so she has some time. And she makes her way downstairs, and she sees the neighbors on the other side of the street, and she starts crying out to them. Now, she can't get the door open because it is bolted closed, but again, this is kind of a crappy house and crappy stuff. So she's able to get her voice to go out and through the mail slot, essentially, and scream for help. This is May 6th, 2013.
So it's about 10 minutes before 6 p.m. when Amanda Berry is yelling for help. She gets the attention of a couple of guys. One of them is Charles Ramsey, who was a dishwasher at a downtown restaurant. He was eating a McDonald's hamburger of some type.
I'm sure McDonald's is not a sponsor of this show. Sorry. Definitely not.
But this comes in later. Anyway, he and this other neighbor,
Miguel,
hurry over to this door.
The bottom half of the door is like piece of aluminum or sheet metal or something, just real flimsy, but it's made to keep people in, not made to keep people out. So he kicks through it, and he's able to bust out the bottom half of this door, and Amanda's able to crawl out, and she just hugs him. And what does Ramsey say?
Charles Ramsey says, and this is a famous quote now, "I knew something was wrong when a pretty little white girl ran into a black man's arms."
Yeah. She's able to get to the neighbor's house with the help of Charles and Miguel, call 911, and you can hear this famous call from Amanda pleading with the operator to send the police. Some people criticize the 911 operator's tone with her, but they were asking her, who did this to you and what is he wearing? Now, she doesn't know what he was wearing, but I actually think it's a legit question because they want to nail this guy. I don't fault the 911 operator myself. I thought it was a legit call. They dispatched the police, who got there pretty quick.
And when the police showed up, Amanda told them about the other two women in the house.
And she was terrified that he was going to come back. This just shows how the human mind is not logical. She's out of the house. She is surrounded by neighbors, yet she's still petrified that he's going to come home and take her again.
Well, it was terrifying for Michelle and for Gina because, you know, they hear this banging at the front of the house and they think something bad is going down.
Yeah.
They think it's like an invasion. They think they're going to be shot and killed. They have no idea. It's not until two police officers show up in the room that they're hiding in when Michelle runs out and just jumps into this officer's arms. They're ready to be saved, but that their first instinct was, we're going to die. Michelle went to the hospital, and she spent some days there because she was so battered.
She weighed 80 pounds at the time of her rescue, and she had a very serious bacterial infection. She was so bad that they decided that they were going to put her in hospice because they thought she only had a few days to live. That's how bad off she was. And can you imagine surviving this turmoil for a decade only to get out and be told you only have 2 days to live and to be put in hospice?
Yeah, she had a rough life as was. I mean, leading up to the kidnapping and all the abuse and all that, and then getting out and being told, yeah, we don't know. You know, it's not looking good.
She had really given up. I think she had accepted death. I know I wouldn't have made it if I had even been subjected to a fraction of what she'd gone through. She remembered what she was doing right before she was abducted, which was fighting for her son, fighting for her child. And she says that gave her strength to keep on going. When she started to heal up, she started writing, getting her health back.
Yeah, it's really sad because the thing that had kept her going was Joey, her son, and she had no idea what had come of him. And then when she got out and started to get better, she really hoped that she could reconnect with him. But when she spoke with someone about this, they said, you know, he's been with a foster family for a long time. They consider him their son. We've now talked with them and they're not sure it's a good idea if you visit because this is not something he'd be prepared for. The only thing she asked for were some pictures of him throughout the years because she said she didn't want to cause him any trouble. She loved her son and she said that's what love is being able to let go. And so with these pictures, you know, she's thinking about her son and just hoping that he had a better life than she did. But this is the survival is it's not just making it through all this. It's how do you make it once you're out? Because Amanda had expressed, how will I ever trust men again? This was difficult for her. You know, like, how am I going to have a relationship again knowing all this stuff that I'd been through? It really destroyed any trust that she had.
Well, I kept hearing it said over and over again, you were rescued. The nightmare's over. That nightmare's never over.
Yeah, we want to think that. We want to think, hey, we fixed this situation. We've arrested this guy. You are now getting help. Amanda and Gina went to their families. Michelle chose not to for obvious reasons, but it's not over.
No.
I mean, this kind of habitual abuse over a decade, that's not something that just goes away.
You got to realize that they were mostly teenagers. And when you're abducted, or let's just say you're put in prison, time stops. You stop. You stop maturing. You stop learning. Everything stops. And now they're rescued 10 years later. They're in their 20s. They're full-grown women. They haven't really progressed past their teens because they haven't lived. And then not only are they rescued, but they're thrust into the media limelight. And this was the biggest story in America and probably the world when they were found. I can't even imagine the pressure of just that. And for Michelle, not wanting to see her family, I mean, dude, I get it. I have a whole podcast that talks about that. It's her decision. I think people need to cut toxic people out of their lives. And sorry, I'm not going to discriminate if you're related by blood or not.
Yeah, her mother had given an interview and had said that when Michelle was younger, they would go and do these different things and they shared all these happy memories. And Michelle's response was, who is she talking about? Because it's not me. I didn't do those things with her. I mean, that's pretty sad. But she said that she doesn't hold any ill will towards her mom. She just doesn't want a relationship with her. Now, the other interesting thing is we're talking about how do you come back from this? Because surviving isn't just it. It's how do you move forward? I think Amanda and the other two women were very conscious of Jocelyn because she was living in this dim house. And even though she had the run of the house, they wanted to make sure she had as normal a childhood as they could make it. Mm-hmm. And so Amanda would request that Ariel bring stuff back home for her, coloring books. And then she would also tell Jocelyn, okay, because, you know, by the time she was rescued, she was about 6 years old. So when she was of school age, Amanda would say, okay, we have to get ready to go to school now. And she would kind of do this walk around with her and then go over to where her school area was.
And then they start teaching her.
Yeah. And so I think that's incredible. Again, she was that hope that they needed, someone that they were there to protect and to look after and help raise, where it gave them purpose. Because just surviving, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask of anyone. And they somehow were doing that. And on top of it, they came together and were helping this little girl.
It's incredible. I highly suggest that people read the books, but I get it. They're not an easy read. So what happened to the monster? They were able to track down Castro also fairly quick. He was with his brother. They were driving. And they get pulled over at the McDonald's, which is the running theme in this episode, apparently. Cops pull him over. And there's a cop on either side of the car demanding their IDs, or at least Castro's ID. But his brother asks the cop next to him, do you want to see my ID? And that cop pretty much just pulls his gun and says, you guys need to get out of the car. His other brother is at home asleep, and he's interrupted by the police, and he's taken to jail. None of them are told what they're being arrested for or anything, and they kind of have to figure it out when they're in the jail cell and ask other inmates and whatever to get the paperwork, which says kidnapping. His brother had like an open container ticket that he thought was unpaid, and it got a warrant for his arrest. So he really thought he was in jail for an open container. The other brother kind of had a good idea that Castro was the problem here. He said, you'll never see me again. Pretty good indication that he knew why they were arresting him. There's a lot of discussion about whether his brothers or his family knew about this. And I'm of the mind that they did not have any indication. The way they speak about him is they're just as harsh as anyone else. Also, usually at the time of an arrest and whatnot, it's every man for himself. People start turning on each other. They start distancing themselves from the crime or putting it off on others. You don't have any of that. His brothers have no clue. Castro doesn't implicate them either. I don't think this is a family coming together to protect somebody. They truly did not have a clue of what a monster their brother was.
Yeah, Castro, some might think that there are two sides to him. Because on the one hand, he was taking Jocelyn to church. And then before he would go to church, he was raping one of these women. And again, he would do that. Let's have a conversation. Let's talk about this show. The next minute, he would be abusing them. I'm not sure there were two sides to this guy. When you read through the books, it seems apparent to me, at least, that he had a lot of issues with how his common law wife, his wife, her name is Grimelda, that she had left him. He had always threatened her and abused her. As time had gone on, it got worse, where he was locking her in the home. He was forcing her to wear clothing that was very long and covered her up. He did not want her going anywhere, talking with anyone. After he had beaten her for I don't know how many times, her family decided to take action in their own hands because, you know, she just couldn't follow through and see that he was put away. She couldn't testify against him because he had her under his thumb. He abused her so much, she lived in fear of him. Well, one day, her father and brother showed up and literally beat the crap out of him. And when he got back up, he was smiling. And they said that he had that attitude of, whatever, see what happens. He didn't care.
Oh, he's so twisted and screwed up. A beating like that doesn't get through to someone like that.
He wasn't content with letting that go because there was a man by the name of Fernando Colon, who, I hope I'm saying that name right, Fernando Colon, who was the security guard at the hospital. He took it upon himself to go over and sort of intervene in this situation. And he went and talked with Grimelda, who went by Nilda, and he told her, he said, this doesn't have to be the way it is. He said, you need to get out of that house. And so she had left Castro with his help and took most of her children with her, except for Angela, the oldest, because she wanted to stay with her dad.
Yeah. I mean, she endured many beatings, broken bones, broken ribs, nose, arm.
Teeth.
She had a blood spot on her brain from blunt force trauma.
He had hit her with barbell as well.
Yeah.
And he had actually gotten into it with Fernando and threatened him because Fernando and his ex, Nilda, actually had a kid together at some point and they married. He was really ticked off, but Fernando stood his ground. But it didn't really end there because then Castro started saying, oh yeah, he's sexually abusing my daughters over there. It started a whole legal mess. People stood by him and he made it through that, but it was pretty devastating. So he is a monster. He gets, we're going to shorten this up here, but he goes to court and he's found guilty.
Well, he pled not guilty, though.
In his mind, he's like, I'm not as bad as they say I am. He's trying to say that there was harmony in the house.
But if you watch his interrogation video, like I did, I wish I hadn't, he puts a lot of the blame on the women. And he puts blame on, weren't there security cameras around when I abducted her? Why didn't you catch me? Why did they get into the car? What were they wearing? I mean, these are the same arguments we hear in other cases, but...
The victim.
Yeah.
For one, the camera wasn't working. Everyone saw through all this stuff. And, when they initially charged him, they only gave him like so many counts of kidnapping. That really bothered Michelle. But as they found out later, when they actually put forth all the charges, it was well over 900. Here are the charges as issued by a grand jury against Ariel Castro. 977 counts. That's 512 counts of kidnapping, 446 counts of rape, 7 counts of gross sexual imposition, 6 counts of felonious assault, 3 counts of child endangerment, 2 counts of aggravated murder in which Castro is accused of intentionally causing the termination of a pregnancy, and 1 count of possessing criminal tools. Castro agreed to a plea deal which recommended that he be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And under that deal, he agreed to plead guilty to 937 counts. It was on August 1st, 2013, that he was sentenced. And so when he was sentenced, he was given life plus 1,000 years.
Which sounds fair to me. They were considering the death penalty due to the induced miscarriages from the torture and beating that he did to Michelle. So I personally don't support a death penalty, but it's based more on the faith of our system, not because I don't think some people deserve to die. And I think this was such a heinous case that I was surprised they didn't go for the death penalty. Instead, they end up going for a life sentence to the tune of he's never getting out.
Well, I recall that the sense I got from reading the books is that these women really felt that they wanted him to consider what he had done. They wanted him to live with this, with the shame of everyone knowing what he had done, because he always put up a front. That front was gone now. He was exposed. They wanted him to live with that. So I think that's maybe one of the reasons why they didn't pursue that. I mean, that's sometimes a consideration. What do the victims want here?
I'm sure that the prosecutor talked to them and abided.
Ariel Castro tried to play the sympathy card. He tried saying that when he was a young boy that another boy who was a neighbor abused him sexually, and that his mother was very, very mean to him and treated him cruelly.
But I bet his life has nothing, doesn't hold a candle to Michelle's.
Yeah. And well, that's the thing, is no one really buys this. Like, some people think it's possible that he may have had a little bit of rough goings on when he was a kid, but that doesn't explain what he did to these women at all. It's not an excuse. It's not a good explanation. He's not a sympathetic character. There's nothing about him that's sympathetic. When they searched his home, they found that in 2004, he was actually thinking about taking his own life.
Yeah, he said that wanted to let the devil deal with him, and that he fought with his actions. Really? If the captain were here, he would say, well, missed opportunity. He should have done it, right?
Ariel doesn't serve a sentence, though. And that's because one day, while he's being held, he decides that he's going to kill himself by hanging.
He's not on suicide watch. The guards that are supposed to be watching him and checking on him every 30 minutes, I guess, actually doctored the records. Like, they hadn't been checking on him, but they wrote down that they had, which they kind of got caught in a lie, because he's somehow got the sheet off and tied up, and he's taken his own life because he can't even go a month in captivity where everyone's treating him fairly and giving him food. He couldn't even make it a month.
That was torture for him.
I wish that we had some sort of medical technology where we could bring him back and let him live for 1,000 years and finish out his sentence.
Yeah, that would be justice.
That truly would.
You know, I think, you know, having read Michelle's book, she said some things I think are really important here that made this easier for me to handle, because back when this all went down and he killed himself, I thought, man, that sucks. We're not going to see justice here. But for her, what she said was important was she outlived him. She outlasted him. She was stronger than him. In fact, the whole book, she calls him Dude. But she said, after all this happened, she realized she can use his name. She can call him Ariel Castro because he has no power. He was weak. He was only strong when everything was his way. These women had to endure everything when it wasn't their way. And they made it.
And they
he
made
didn't.
They made it to trial to give their victim impact statements, to tell him to his face what he'd done.
Michelle was the last to speak. The other two women chose not to speak. They had relatives there that spoke for them who read their statements. They did prepare statements. Michelle wanted to speak because that for her was important, because it wasn't enough just to survive and make it out of there. She wanted to be able to look him in the face and tell him, because she was ticked off that he was out there trying to say, oh, well, I was abused and things weren't that bad. He was trying to twist things just like how her mother did. And so she was there to clear things up, and she wanted him to know that she was standing in front of him and was strong, and she did it. Amanda Berry's mother, her health was declining. She was so sick over not knowing what was going on with her daughter, and she felt some guilt because they hadn't ended things on a good note. She ended up dying, I believe it was in 2006, while Amanda was still in captivity. She wasn't around to see her rescued. The books that I read, I recommend reading them. Michelle Knight, now known as Lily Rose Lee. Her book, Finding Me, A Decade of Darkness, A Life Reclaimed, which she has done. And then Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus wrote a book, Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. I recommend both those books. If you don't shed a tear or two, I'd be surprised.
And Gina's gone on to help law enforcement with recovering missing children and is a part of the process and help support the children when they're finally recovered.
Something that Michelle had said when asked, how did you get through it? How are you not broken? And her response is, if you already went through torture in your life, you can't be broken twice. You can only survive after that. This might be weird, but this statement makes me want to jump out of my chair and applaud. It's very powerful. Might not be the reaction most people have, but anyone that knows me probably can understand why I feel that way.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.